Good evening, James McKinney here with my Science Hour for January 27, 2022. And with the ongoing series this entire year, I will be talking about my history of discoveries. Tonight, I'll be going into my Tulane years, what I call the Tulane years, getting my master's degree in nuclear and solid state physics. And so I'll be talking a bit about that. But also the interesting thing is that this set me up eventually to get my teaching position at Cornell. And it was like somebody was moving me and guiding me and making almost like making decisions for me. For example, when I was at Tulane, I finished with my master's degree and was offered the opportunity from my advisor to continue and get my PhD. And I decided, no, I did not want to do that, which was typically not done. Typically, a person in that position would take the offer another 2 years, possibly 3 more years, get a PhD. And then that's like the golden ticket to life in that world of education. And I said no. I said no to a lot of interesting opportunities in my life and took a different route. And that was one of them. But if I would have gotten my PhD at Tulane, my life would have been very different. I would not have what I did after Tulane is I applied to about 25 institutions internationally and universities to go teach physics, mathematics, etc. And I picked one. And that's where I went for the next 4 years. So I had the experience of teaching in a foreign language, physics, mathematics, and computer science, so that when I did end up at Cornell, when I applied, because that's why I went up to Cornell, I ended up in Ithaca, New York, for other reasons, which were totally, totally extraneous. I end up in Ithaca, New York, and I was actually working there in another capacity. And so I said, you know, why don't I go up to Cornell, great university, and see if I can get my PhD? And I would not have done that if I would have gotten my PhD at Tulane. So I go to Cornell, to apply to become a student when I go up for my interview in the physics department. They tell me, no, I cannot be a student, but I can teach there. And they offered me a teaching position at Cornell with my master's degree, and for all of those goody-two-shoes out there that go, oh, only PhDs teach at big universities. Well, back then that was not true. And a place like Cornell, of course, did have a high percentage of PhDs teaching there, but it was not unheard of for a master's degree person with qualifications. It was like I walked in the day that they were looking for a person for bilingual teaching, mathematics and computer science and physics in the physics department. So I had all the qualifications. I had the electronics qualifications. And my first position there was in teaching electronics. And so, what happened then, I'm not going to go into that now. That'll come later. But my point is that if I would have gotten my PhD at Tulane, I would never have ended up in Ithaca when I did. And the timing was perfect. Ending up at Cornell in 1979, that's when all of the spacecraft were coming to fruition. The Pioneer, the Voyager 1, Voyager 2, the Venus probes, all of this data was coming in. I mean, it was just flooding in. The solar probes, the IC 1 and 2 and 3 space probes were being built and employed. And so, my ending up at Cornell at exactly that time was instrumental in everything that happened to me. So, it was like somebody was guiding me. And I also want to mention that when I was at Tulane, of course, that's in New Orleans, I rode my bike a lot. I lived up off of St. Charles Avenue, up the end of the St. Charles Avenue, which is, if you know anything about New Orleans, That's the main artery that runs through Old New Orleans, which goes back to the 1500s. Literally, a lot of the buildings there, very old, the mansions along St. Charles, and going downtown to the French Quarter. And so I had my own office at the physics building at Tulane, and would get on the streetcar on an afternoon, finish with my work, jump on the streetcar, go downtown, and people watch down in the French Quarter, and I'd go to the Napoleon House. And wow, there were some amazing people watching. But there was a guy who lived upstairs in the Napoleon House that would come down on key every night, and he was dressed like Napoleon. And I mean, he looked like Napoleon. He looked like, and I mean, it could have been, as far as I knew, Napoleon Bonaparte. And he had his hand in his jacket, in his lapel, just exactly as you see Napoleon. But the whole point of the Napoleon House was, after Napoleon's second rise to power in Europe, remember the first time they banned him, I think it was to Sicily, one of the islands. And he mustered up an army, and he came back and came into Europe, into France, and just started another big war, a massive, large war. And that time, when he had his Waterloo, they took him and they said, we got to get this guy out of here completely. So they took him to the New World, basically to New Orleans, which was a French-owned region at the time, the French Louisiana, what ended up to be the Louisiana Purchase. But New Orleans was a port, a very good port, very safe harbor, deep harbor port. And they put Napoleon there and basically guarded him in this place, in the French Quarter. It's called the Napoleon House. You can still go there, a little quaint little place. I suggest if you get to New Orleans, you definitely go there and you'd see where I spend some time. But I would also take my work down there because it was a quiet environment. Everybody there was eclectic. I may just use that term. And I would take my work down there. It was a wonderful place to think, you know, in a very quiet environment, and a little bit of quiet music in the background, typically classical French music, etc. But anyway, back to riding my bicycle around. When I'd go down to the French Quarter, I'd take the streetcar. And just for example, one time I was going down in the afternoon on a streetcar, and it stopped. It never stopped. It would always keep going, and there was a lot of activity. And I looked out the side, and there was a film crew there, a full-blown Hollywood film crew going on. And I looked over in the car, and it was like a Ford Fairlane automobile, and in the back seat was Paul Newman. And so anyway, there was a house on St. Charles where they were filming The Drowning Pool. It's a movie. You can see it. It's still on, available. It's called The Drowning Pool with Paul Newman and his wife, Joanne Woodward. And I saw Paul there. In fact, I saw Paul second time when I was up at Ithaca. I used to go over to the racetrack, and I'll think of the town that's near Ithaca where the racetrack is, a famous racetrack. And I went over there to just see it. I think it's called Watson Glen, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, there's a famous racetrack there for automobiles, for like high performance, like Porsche literally automobiles, not the Formula One or two or three. Automobiles, and there was Paul Newman driving his, it looked like an early version of a Mercedes. And he was driving it around. That was one of his passions, was racing, race car driving. And he was driving his car around the racetrack at Watson Glen. And I'll leave it there about any more contact, but The second time I saw Paul Newman, interestingly enough, was when I was at Ithaca, and then once when I was in New Orleans at Tulane. But when I would just go around town, visit friends, etc., up in the uptown area, up the upper end of St. Charles Avenue, near where I lived, I would ride my bicycle, and I rode my bicycle around the levees. Now, this turned out to be important. Remember, I said it's like somebody was guiding me. Here, Mr. McCanny, ride your bicycle around the levees all around New Orleans. And there was like a bicycle tracks on a lot of them, and just an area where you could ride. So I knew the levees of New Orleans like the back of my hand. So when Katrina hit, the manipulated storm, one of the very first major manipulated storms, and to come in and destroy New Orleans, it actually petered out. They couldn't keep it with the laser-manipulated hurricane. And by the way, I'm the one that developed the process for that with the Russian scientists in the mid-1990s for the manipulation of hurricanes. So I knew what they were doing. In the early 2000s, the Russian scientists that I worked with from the University of Novosibirsk went to the United Nations, and they said the United States is developing weapons of war, of basically mass destruction against the public in the form of these laser satellites. And we knew they were building them and putting them up. It started around the year 2000, and Katrina was one of the first major controlled hurricanes. And so anyway, and I was in a very high-end restaurant establishment where people would come with boats. Very rich people would come with boats. And when Katrina was still in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, I heard them talking about Katrina hitting New Orleans and the effect it would have on oil futures and the amount of money that they were going to make because they were investing based on the knowledge that Katrina was going to hit New Orleans. This is when Katrina was still in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And I'm hearing this. These are just normal, rich people who have the word, invest in, this is how you invest in the oil futures because it's going to be affected by the hurricane Katrina hitting New Orleans. And then Katrina comes around the tip of Florida, comes into the Gulf of Mexico, and goes directly south of New Orleans a few hundred miles, and then makes a 90-degree right turn just on cue and goes straight up to New Orleans. But the point of riding on the levees with my bicycle when I was at Tulane getting my master's degree was that after the hurricane passed, there was not a lot of damage. There was some wind damage, and like Tulane itself had some wind damage. It was relatively minor. They blew the levees in seven places. So it was like explosions where they had basically barges filled with explosives sitting next to the levees and blew them up so that they would flood New Orleans because the hurricane was supposed to flood New Orleans. And it was basically a genocide operation to kill the people, especially the poor black people down in the lower wards. And so the hurricane didn't do it. So the hurricane had already passed Lake Pontchartrain. And then the news claim was that it was a surge from the hurricane, like sometimes precedes a hurricane. But you have to understand New Orleans is up the river from the Gulf of Mexico, and there's no way to get a surge up there from the hurricane, but especially after the hurricane had already passed. And I saw security cameras down in the French Quarter online, because they're online, from the city of New Orleans, and there were people walking around. There were people walking around, and it was kind of drizzling, and no big deal. And then all of a sudden, the levees blow in seven places, and it floods New Orleans. And that was the damage, the major damage from Hurricane Katrina, allegedly, was from the flooding that happened after the hurricane had already passed. And there was some damage that was east of New Orleans in Mississippi because they really missed the Hurricane Katrina, really missed, the eye missed New Orleans. And so there was very minimal damage in New Orleans. And then they blew the levee in seven places and claimed that it was like a back surge from the hurricane coming across Lake Pontchartrain. Well, that was a lie, and I knew that. I knew that. I went on radio shows as soon as they blew the levees and made the claim that it was flooding New Orleans. I remember I went on to, I think it was Alex Merklinger's show. I was in my car. I was on a trip. And I called in to Alex Merklinger's show, and I said, I was really mad. I said, I knew they blew the levees. And that's why I could say that with confidence, because I knew the levees personally. But this is one of the points I want to make, is that it's like I was in these places for a reason, only to be materialized many years, in case this case, decades later, because my Tulane years were around 73 to 75. And so, interestingly enough, I'm going to say this too, that the teaching job I got in Mexico, student position I got to get my PhD at Tulane, which I ended up getting my master's degree, and the position at Cornell, interestingly enough, I walked in the day that they were looking for a person like me. And so I'll go back to the position in Mexico. This is my first job after college. I got out of college. I had three offers to get my PhD. And I decided to put them on hold, and I called up the one that I chose, and I said, I don't want to go to grad school right now. And this, they told me that they would hold my student fellowship for 3 years. And all I had to do is come back at any time, and I could take it back. And I said, okay, you know, I'm going to take this opportunity. And so I went to Mexico. I'm in Mexico City, and I went into the office of the school where I ended up getting a teaching job. And when I was standing there, the principal of the school had big stacks of files on his desk on both sides, and you could hardly see him. There were so many stacks of papers and files on his desk. And I said, hi, I have a bachelor's degree in physics and mathematics, and I can teach, you know, and could I get a teaching job here? Because I wanted to come back and live in Mexico, but I wanted an income. I wanted a way to provide for myself when I was there. And the guy looked at me, he said, you see all these papers stacked on my desk? He said, today my job is to go through these and find a science and mathematics teacher. And he said, you just got the job. Because I saved him going through all of those papers, and I was a live person. He could see me. And so anyway, I had the qualification. So I got the job because I was there exactly at the right time when the principal needed to hire somebody for exactly what I wanted to do. In Tulane, the exact same thing happened. I went to Tulane, and actually I was visiting a girlfriend that I had met in Mexico. And she was from a student exchange program from the University of Alabama. And so anyway, I went to New Orleans, where she eventually got a teaching job. I went to visit her, and I went up to Tulane. And I walked in, and the professor who ended up being my advisor at Tulane had the same thing. He said, I'm looking, I just got this big grant from the National Institute of Health to study zero radiography, which was my specialty. That's what the nuclear and solid state physics was all about, because I was combining nuclear and solid state. I was studying detectors for radiography using x-rays. And so that's what I spent about 2 years exactly getting my master's degree. From May of 1973 to about May of 1975, and that's when I left for my university teaching position in a foreign country. and spent 4 years doing that. And then when I ended up in Ithaca after that, I went into the physics department at Cornell, and lo and behold, that day, the head of the physics department was looking for somebody to teach physics and mathematics, physics, mathematics, engineering, mathematics, at Cornell, and also electronics, which I had a background in. He was looking for somebody that could teach in a bilingual setting, because that's what they were lacking at Cornell in the physics department, were people with qualifications to teach university-level physics and mathematics in a foreign language, which I just had. And like I say, it was like somebody was prepping me for all of this to end up at Cornell at exactly the right time, when all this data was coming in from spacecraft. And that was before NASA realized they had to put the lid on the data because they didn't want people like me seeing it. Anyway, I'm just moving ahead a little bit. I'll be talking about some of these other issues. But the whole point is that it was like somebody was prepping me for this major event in my life, which was getting the teaching position at Cornell. And then when I was at Cornell, of course, I had the big row with the physics department over publishing my papers on the electrical nature of the solar system and comets, etc., and comets becoming planets. Because little did I know, I'll say this now too, about this history, I had never heard about Immanuel Velikovsky in Worlds and Collisions and Ages and Chaos, Earth and Upheaval, the Velikovsky books, and the big row with Carl Sagan. Now, Carl Sagan, of course, was the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy at Cornell during the time that I was there. In fact, when I was at Cornell from 1979, the fall semester of 1979, through the spring semester of 1981, so that's two full academic years, I was at Cornell. The big row I had with the physics department was in the first semester. They called me in. They said, "What are you doing here?" I was called into the physics department office, and the head of the physics department, who had hired me, had my papers that were being refereed, basically, in peer-reviewed journals on his desk. He said, "What's this?" I said, "Well, it looks like you have my papers on your desk." He says, "You can't do this. This is, we teach correct physics here." That's what he told me. His exact words. Doug Fitchin was his name, head of the physics department at Cornell when I was there. And Carl Sagan, I never saw him at Cornell. He was in Hollywood making the Cosmos series. But he very much affected my life in that was instrumental in getting me fired. And, of course, when my work started appearing in journals using the data that I got at Cornell and referencing NASA data, because NASA had a institution at, basically, a lot of NASA scientists worked at Cornell. And it was a Library of Congress, and it was a depository of NASA data. So all of the NASA data was at Cornell, up in the Space Science Department, and I had access to it. It was just open. And eventually they shut it down so only the principal investigators could have the data. And then if there was any data released, it was released after it was completely massaged, homogenized, and blended by the principal investigators of good old NASA. Anyway, the point is that after my semester there, which I was, cloistered, I guess that's the best word, because when Doug got mad at me that day, he said, "I need you to teach here, but you can't talk to the students about your work. You cannot continue using the name of Cornell on your publications." And that's what he told me. But he said, "I would fire you, but I need you to teach here." So I continued to teach there in the physics department, but he had a woman, Dr. Robinson, this lady, whose job was to follow me around when I was on campus. And she did. She did. When I was in the classroom, she was there. When I was walking around campus, she would follow me around so that I would not talk to students about my work. If you can imagine this. And so this went on, and at the end of the semester, Doug said, okay, enough of you, you're out of here. But by then, I had taken up residence in the mathematics department, and they hired me there because I could teach the same situation. I could teach the mathematics, the calculus courses, which I had experience in my previous teaching position. I could teach calculus, and they needed somebody in calculus. So here I walk across campus. How many people do you know that would happen to, that would be, in a sense, terminated in the physics department, walk across campus and be rehired by the mathematics department? So there you'll see that my peer-reviewed published papers in the astrophysics journals that has J.M. McCanney, Department of Mathematics, Cornell University. And they were happy as could be to have me publishing in peer-reviewed astrophysics journals. In fact, they told me, the head of the mathematics department, Wolfgang Fuchs, told me, he was a German guy, very good mathematician. He called me into his office and he said, you know, I'm getting very good reviews from your students. They love your teaching. And he said, you're the only faculty member in the Department of Mathematics in the history of Cornell who has ever published in peer-reviewed astrophysics journals. He said, congratulations, you know, keep doing it. And so anyway, that's just a little bit of history, but it was like somebody was moving me and somebody was helping me out. And here's another little connection that I'll make, is when I was in Mexico, I was teaching, I'm not going to go into any more detail, but I was teaching in Mexico when I was the first year I was out of college. And so I went to Mexico, got this teaching job, which I told you about. And I spent my weekends and time off and Christmas vacations and Easter break and everything traveling around seeing the archaeological ruins of Mexico. While my cohort friends and other people in the United States were still fighting the Vietnam War, I was in Mexico visiting archaeological ruins and did not really realize I was just following my nose. Once again, somebody guiding me. And here I am 9 years later when I'm at Cornell meeting the person who, and of course, at that point, I was developing my work with comets, electrical nature of comets, and the development of solar systems where comets become planets, and the physics of how that works. And I go into the office at Cornell of the newly formed archaeoastronomy department. And so I have my background in understanding archaeology, Mexico, Central American, Mayan archaeology, and the physics of it, and how in Mayan archaeology you have Quetzalcoatl. The Aztecs have a similar type of deity. The Peruvian Incas had their version of Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky. And I had this understanding of Quetzalcoatl, and also I'll tell this little story. It was during the Christmas break that year. I went with my Ford window van that I had purchased. I mentioned that when I went to Mexico to teach, I bought a brand new Ford window van with air conditioning and nothing in it, just empty, and with a pad. In fact, my dear old mother went down and bought me a foam pad and a piece of kind of like indoor-outdoor carpeting to put on the floor because it was just pure metal when I bought it. And interestingly enough, my dad also purchased for me a piece of metal screen because he had lived in Texas during World War II and he knew I'd be driving through Texas during this August time of year. And he said, that's when there's butterflies all over the place down there. He said, you put this screen on because they will plug up your radiator. So you have to put this. My dad knew this. And so when I drove through Texas on my way to Mexico, sure enough, I hit the butterfly season. And it was that screen that saved me from having a big mess in the radiator in my car. So anyway, But I, the Christmas break that year that I was teaching in Mexico, I went down to Quintana Roo, which is now where Cancun is. Most of you would be familiar with the area of Cancun, which is in the area of southeastern Mexico on the Caribbean. It's the whole eastern coast from Yucatan on down to Belize. And so anyway, I went with some friends, and when we got down to Mérida, it was very different than it is today. It was very primitive. Quintana Roo was a territory. It was not a state, an official state of Mexico. It was like the Wild West, literally. And they had just completed a new road using seashells. And you could see the big pits. And today, if you drive from what is now Cancun, which was not even there at the time, there was nothing, Cancun did not exist in 1971. But from that region, on this new road, it went and connected to Tulum, which is, of course, right now one of the tourist spots. And that whole coastline is absolutely pristine, gorgeous beach with one of the largest reefs offshore, about a mile offshore, that runs that whole coastline. But anyway, if you drive on the new road, what is the current road between Cancun and Tulum, it is a regular modern road. But on adjacent to it, on the seaside, you can see still bits and pieces of the road, which was new in 1971, made of seashells. And you can pull off and actually park on parts of it. But it was there were very large pits, and these pits were probably 20 meters deep and 100 meters by 100 meters, just to give you an idea of the size. And they dug this out and made the road. And it was literally seashells. It was kind of tough on the tires because the seashells were fresh. And literally, my van, along with another person that was on an exploratory trip, were the first cars to go down that road when it was opened up. In fact, we had to wait a couple of days for the road to officially open completely. But we were the first people to traverse that road down to Tulum, which opened up Tulum for tourism. And so at that point, we camped on the beach, up in the little woods up off the beach, like a palm. And I, for 2 weeks, lived off coconuts and conch shells. Would I swim out to the reef every day and dive down and get conch. And so there was rice, conch, and coconuts. That was what I ate for 2 weeks. But the exploring the ruins at Tulum had already been at the ruins at Chichen Itza and Uxmal and the rest of them. They were still, quite a few of them, still under development and under reconstruction. But when I was at Tulum, I had heard that there was a small Lacandon village back in the jungle. So I decided that I would take a walk through the jungle and go to visit that city. The city, it was like a little teeny town. It may have been maybe 100 people living there. But these were Lacandon Indians, the descendants of the Maya, and they were still speaking their Mayan language when I got there. And on the path, there was a cave. And they, the people that told me about the Lacandon village said, when you see the cave, just go in it, but don't disturb anything. So I went into the cave on the way, and I walked down in, and it was like there were fish floating in the air. I looked down, and I was like, I can't believe this. There are fish that are floating in the air. And the water was so clean. These were freshwater caves, limestone caves. The water was so absolutely clear that you could see the fish, and it looked like they were floating in the air, little colorful, maybe 3-inch-long tropical fish. And so anyway, I continued on to the Lacandon village, and when I got there, they welcomed me with open arms. So I went into this hut with a group of guys. They were drinking mezcal, which is a homemade tequila. It's a homemade tequila made by the local people. And they had a bottle there, and it had a worm in the bottom. And the thing that you would do to a visitor there that you wanted to welcome is that you would let them drink the worm. This was like a special, you know, a special offering to welcome you into their village. So they indicated how to do this, because I didn't, you know, I didn't speak their language. They didn't even speak Spanish. And so I took the bottle and I poured it up, and the worm slowly floats down through the mezcal, which was like murky. It had a lot of stuff floating in it, until I drank the worm. And when I drank the worm, it was like I won the Super Bowl. Everybody screamed and hollered and was like I was welcomed into the town. And so I went over, they showed me around the town, and they had little chickens and little birds that they had eggs from, and they literally lived there completely isolated. And so I went into this, what appeared to be a little store, a little hut that a woman had, and she had a little counter, and she had products behind her that were local, you know, eggs or coconuts or other things like that. And the only thing she had from the modern world was condensed sweetened milk. And so anyway, I bought a can of that and some other fruit, etc. And this was, by this time, the end of the day. It was getting close to sundown. And I looked up above this woman's head, and above her head was a quetzal bird, which is a bird of paradise. It's a very rare bird that lives in the jungle of eastern Yucatan and Quintana Roo. But here's one live sitting above her head on a perch. And the indication was that the quetzal birds roost in the daytime and fly at night. And this is characteristic. Now, the reason I'm telling you this story is because of what happened next. The quetzal bird opened its wings, kind of fluttered its wings, and kind of shook like it was waking up. And it took off, and it flew over my head out of this hut. So it was like 2 feet above my head when I saw this thing fly over me. And with the wings expanded, the color of the plumage on the bottom was the shape of a comet. Now, why is this important? Because this made the connection for me between Quetzalcoatl, the Mayan plumed serpent god of the night sky, and the comets. And it had, if you take a look at my electrical drawings, the electric fields of a comet, this is the exact plumage coloration on the bottom of the quetzal bird. And then, of course, it has the long tail out there, very like a meter long tail coming out the backside of the bird. So the bird is not really big, but it has all this beautiful plumage. And it flew directly over my head. And so I understood that that's why the Mayans called Quetzalcoatl and the bird, quetzal bird, associating them with Quetzalcoatl, who was the comet Venus. And of course, this is in the Popol Vuh, that Venus was the great comet that destroyed the Mayan cities. And this is the Velikovsky dating for this is around 1500 BC, when the Venus, the comet, came through the solar system. And and Quetzalcoatl took on various personas, and this is very common. Also, something I learned in dealing with these my study in Mexico of the traditions of the Mayas, the Aztecs, etc., is Quetzalcoatl was also the corn god, and Quetzalcoatl was a person who brought corn to the Mayas. And that was, of course, their staple food. And so they had these various personas. So you had to understand that when they said Quetzalcoatl, it meant a person that brought corn. It meant the plumed serpent god of the night sky. It meant this bird. And it meant also deities. And there were brothers and sisters of Quetzalcoatl which was my first indication that when I started understanding the issue of comets and Venus becoming the comet becoming the planet Venus, that there were multiple big comets in the sky at the time. And so anyway, but the other thing I wanted to mention also is even when I was at Cornell, I did not realize the hornet's nest that I had stepped into. I did not realize the issue that Carl Sagan had with Velikovsky and the whole Velikovsky affair. I didn't know anything about it because I had been out of the country. I had been at Tulane, I'd been out of the country, and this was just not something that crossed my path. It was only after I left Cornell, after I'd done my theoretical work, my using NASA data to confirm that comets were not dirty snowballs, that they were the plasma discharge of the solar capacitor, and all my theoretical work and all the data was there supporting it. Only then did I learn about Velikovsky. I was talking to a friend of mine on the telephone, telling him about my publications and things like that, and he goes to me, this guy was a scholar, a friend of mine that I'd grown up with, and he said, you know, it sounds like that Velikovsky guy. He said, and I said, well, who's that? He said, well, he had this concept that Venus was a comet and became the planet Venus. And I'm going, oh, really? And this is after I had been my 2 years at Cornell. And so anyway, eventually I got to know all of the people involved in the Velikovsky issue, including Louis Greenberg, who was the editor of Kronos, and then Leroy Ellenberger was one of the editors there, a very kind of cantankerous person, a very well-educated person. But then also Warner Sizemore, who I later interviewed. He's on my 18 hours of MP3 lectures. Warner, I have 2 hours of interview with him. It's very worth listening to Warner, because he was Velikovsky's private secretary. And so anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, but I'm just trying to put this entire pattern together, indicating that, yes, some things that I were doing, what is the probability of somebody going to a Lacandon village in the middle of the Tulum jungle on a given evening, and I'm standing there at exactly the right time when this bird of paradise decides to leave its roost and fly out of the hut. And I see the bottom of the plumage, and this is the key to me understanding why they named the bird Quetzal Bird, because it is after Quetzalcoatl, because the plumage on the underside looks like the comet with the big long tail, the big long flowing tail, bird of paradise. And so, like I say, somebody was guiding me. There's no question. I mean, there's the possibility of somebody doing all of these things. And throughout my life, I've always just said, you know, take care of planning my life. The world is too complicated. My job would be to be a dedicated scholar, not work for the government, be honest. The first thing you have to be when you're a scientist or a mathematician is you have to have honesty. And that's where the 99.99% of everybody who's a physicist, engineer, or a mathematician today, that's where they fall down. They're not honest. Then, and you say, well, how could that be? Well, the reason is because they have their own agendas. They have their agendas that they work under. Let's take prime numbers, for example. The whole field of prime numbers in mathematics, mathematical analysis, is dominated by people with agendas, people that have personal agendas at the things they have studied. And mathematical analysis will never cure the problems of prime numbers. It will never discover the real, true issues of prime numbers. I taught mathematical analysis at the university level. That was one of the courses I taught. So I'm well familiar with mathematical analysis and the entire field of math analysis, the Riemann hypothesis, the golden ratio, the golden key, as it's called, the Euler golden key for prime numbers, relating them to integers, etc. And the Gauss work with modulo number systems, I'm familiar with all of that. And none of it will solve the problems of prime numbers. And when I realized that, I had to be honest with myself and say everything everybody's been doing for the last 2,500 years is not leading anywhere. It's not going anywhere. There has to be an entirely new approach to understanding prime numbers. And the other thing I did was I assumed that there was a simple solution to prime numbers. And that's what led me down my path to discovering the true nature of prime numbers, which are in my published books, Calculate Primes, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, and the first volume of the three-volume set of Principles of Prime Numbers already available on my webpage, and two more volumes coming out. But that's because I was honest. I had to be honest with myself and say, because I was not in this publishing trap, all of the mathematicians today that deal with prime numbers are in this publishing trap, and this belief that the Riemann hypothesis, if solved, would somehow give us understanding of prime numbers, and it will not. And there are very famous people that agree with me on that point, one of them being John Nash, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, and John Derbyshire, who wrote the book Prime Obsession, which is one of the best both technical and public discussions of the whole issue of the Riemann hypothesis. But at the end of his wonderful book, Prime Obsession, John Derbyshire says exactly what I just said. If the Riemann hypothesis were proven to be true, and it's used as an assumption to a lot of work dealing with prime numbers in mathematical analysis, if the Riemann hypothesis were proven to be true, it would not tell us the true nature of prime numbers, the predictability of prime numbers. And that's what my work did when I developed the generator function to calculate prime numbers. And it does it not one at a time, but in groups, very important groups. And it shows that the whole progression of prime number and how to calculate them directly. And using analytical methods, you don't need computers. It was my understanding and also my understanding of nature. So when I went out into nature for sometimes almost months and months at a time, where I spent time out in nature, what I realized was that, and this is an important part of being part of nature, is that nature is very simple. The understanding it is very basic, but it's very complicated also. It's almost infinitely complex. If you try and understand all of the, say, physics of the universe, we're never, ever going to understand all of it. But it's very simple, so we can understand very simple concepts, and that was the issue with prime numbers. And I said, I'm going to apply that to my quest to understand prime numbers. And I did, and that's why I was able to solve the prime number problem of being able to directly calculate prime numbers. And that's, by the way, what broke the encryption codes, and that led to my second book, Breaking RSA Encryption Codes, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. The whole point of that book was to show that by directly calculating prime numbers, you can easily break the encryption codes that are being used today and still being used today, the SSL and the API selection process for 256-bit encryption. I spent later in my life, after I left Cornell, I came back to the real world and I did two things. I spent developing my electromagnetic propulsion systems, and that's where I got involved with these products. That's where I worked with Russian scientists on the development of weather manipulation, weather control, and hurricane control, etc. And then also other things that I did in my life, the work on encryption. But I worked in the electronics industry, the telecommunications industry, for 25 years, incognito. Nobody ever knew when I was doing radio shows. I was on Art Bell. I was on Coast to Coast. I was on with Alex Merklinger. All of the time I was doing this and living my life, I was working at high-level security positions in the telecommunications industry, and one of my specialties was encryption. And so I understood the whole field. And also, when I broke the code, so to speak, on the prime numbers, I understood that it was going to destroy the entire field of encryption. And so when I released that book, Calculate Primes, I literally went to a foreign island. And I set up radio communications where I could do the show. It was released on Coast to Coast AM. And George Norrie was the host. And he was the only person who had seen the book up to that time of that show, the release of the book. And I had mailed out this book, had pre-sold it, and mailed out all over the world. And I went to an island, literally for my own well-being, because it took a while for everybody to realize that the encryption codes that they'd been using in the military and high-level computer security, etc., were broken. And Michael Chertoff, who was the head of Homeland Security after that book was released in 2007. 2 weeks later, Michael Chertoff, the head of Homeland Security, got up on a podium and said, all of our encryption is broken. We don't know how bad it is, and we don't know how to fix it. And that was the result of my releasing that work. And so that's why I had to leave, because I didn't, just for my own self-protection. And then when it became clear, and then people would say to me, well, why did you do that? Why did you publish this? Why didn't you keep it a secret? And the reason is because they would have killed me. If they would have known I had this, they would have stole it, and then it would be sold on the black market. And so I had to release this for the benefit of the public, because it was a protection mechanism. But oddly enough, that's when also the CIA and the NSA were deep into hacking, basically, and gathering data from everybody, their email, their computer systems. And so they could not allow the secret to get out that the SSL protocols, encryption protocols, were broken. And so they kept, and even to this day, they keep driving home the idea, which is false, that these encryption systems are secure. Anyway, I'm just talking about some of the things I did after I left Cornell. And I'll be talking about these in more detail later, but I'm trying to give an overall picture of what I did and I worked and how I made my living and how those positions were perfect for me because they were high security positions. I had high security clearance to work in them. And it allowed me a normal lifestyle, a good income, a secure income, and a way to live a normal life. And most of the people that I worked around did not really know about my other life, my science life, which I managed to keep and maintain. So when I went to American Geophysical Union meetings, when I went to military meetings or electric propulsion meetings with the closed military meetings, etc., I paid my own way. And I never depended on government money, government grants. It would be interesting. I'd go to an American Geophysical Union meeting. I'd have my table set up to NASA. Next to me were the NASA scientists from Goddard, who all knew me. And that's who invited me, for example, to go give invited talks at Los Alamos National Laboratory. So they all knew me. And it would be interesting because occasionally there'd be somebody new. Like this one woman had just gotten her PhD. She had, listen to this, she had raised her family. She had gotten she went back to school and got a PhD in physics and was hired by NASA. So she was in her 50s probably. And she came up to me and I had my table next to hers at the auditorium in the American Geophysical Union meeting. She came up to me and she looked at my badge and it said, Professor James McCanney, independent scientist. And she said, what does independent scientist mean? Because she had her badge, which said Goddard Space Flight Center, and her name. And she said, what does independent scientist mean? And I said, that means that I don't work for the government. I fund my own research. She said, how can you do that? How can you exist without being part of the government programs? And so she had no concept of how I could do my work for all of these years, fund my own research, fund my own passage to these meetings. And everybody knew me, and I was on the cutting edge of discovery in these fields. In that case, we were talking about those particular meetings were dealing with the X-rays in comets, which I had predicted. When I was at Cornell, one of my predictions was that comets would have X-rays to the sunward side, which were later discovered, a great big discovery in 1996. One of the major discoveries of the year was the X-rays in comets, which I had predicted. But of course, NASA suppressed my work to try and promote their own ridiculous story of charge exchange. And I showed that the X-rays were part of the discharge of the solar capacitor and actually had predicted this. Okay, so anyway, I've covered this week a lot of history, and this gives you a kind of a overall feeling for where I had been, where I was going, etc. And later, I'll just mention this, and I just have about a minute left here of this show. I went back to Mexico many times, including going to Chichen Itza and Tulum and Uxmal to survey them with real survey equipment on the ground, only to discover that the old North Pole was north of the state of Michigan in Canada. And there's a lot of work going on right now. A good friend of mine, Mark Gaffney, I work with him in the background all the time, has already published one book that's available on Amazon, and then we're dealing with a second book now, dealing with the pole shift that occurred during the Venus event, where the large comet came by Earth and there was a physical pole shift. And Mark is working on a lot of collaborative ways of looking at that whole issue of Venus having causing Earth to have a physical pole shift. One of the more recent things is discussing how the pole shift caused the magnetic pole to shift also about 30 degrees, and it's now catching up to the true North Pole, the current North Pole. But anyway, I'll be talking about that later. But this was rather a collage of information with dealing with some of my history. I'll be continuing this topic for this entire year, because as you can see, there's a lot involved here. Once again, remember my web pages, jmccwaterfilters.com. You can get a 10% discount using the coupon code JMCC, and my webpage, jmccanyscience.com, short URL, jmccsci.com. And we'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.